Welcome back, everyone. We've been talking with Melvin Dumar, who claims he encountered Howard Hughes in the Nevada desert back in the late 60s, that he picked up Hughes on the side of the road, gave him a ride to Las Vegas, never knew for sure who his passenger was until years later when a copy of the so-called Mormon Will was dropped off at a gas station in Utah by a stranger. Dumar gave that will to the Mormon church. They attempted to verify it. There was a lengthy court battle in Las Vegas. Melvin was no match for the wealthy, well-connected forces that were assembled against him, and the Mormon will was eventually dismissed as sort of a laughable fraud. And then after years of court battles, the Hughes fortune was divvied up between assorted cousins, corporate cronies, and probably the tax man, and Melvin Dumar was sort of relegated to a footnote of the Hughes story. That is, until a former FBI agent entered the case, put a new spin on the whole thing. Gary Magnuson had an exemplary career with the Bureau. He spent the last few years of his active duty chasing mobsters who were engaged in a massive casino skimming operation here in Las Vegas. If you've seen the Martin Scorsese movie Casino, you know who the real-life guys were, because Gary Magnuson personally apprehended a couple of those fellas and put them away. And then after his retirement, because his brother knew Melvin, he got involved in this story and came to believe that Melvin was telling the truth, and now has really uncovered some interesting stuff. Gary, you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for being here. You wrote a book about it, The Investigation. It's an excellent book. The subtitle is A Former FBI Agent Uncovers the Truth Between Howard Hughes, Melvin Dumar, and the Most Contested Will in American History. What was it that, were you in fact convinced that Melvin was probably not telling the truth after that first meeting with him?
Well, when all of this was broke in 1976, I was living in Milwaukee. I was stationed there. And so all I knew about the story was what I had read in the newspaper and a few things on television. So I was very skeptical because I had the assumption that Melvin was either a crook or a nut or something like that. And so I was very, very dubious. And but the thing that struck me when I did interview him, I know he says I was skeptical, and I was, but I thought to myself, why is this man, after all of this time, reopening this whole matter and reopening old wounds that I would think he would want to just let them heal over and let time pass by? But he wanted to start all over again and reopen this thing. And I thought, well, either he's crazy or maybe there's something to this. And so I agreed to look into it a little bit. I didn't expect it to really develop into what it has developed into, but I told him that I would look into it and with an objective view and see what I came up with.
And what was step one, or rather, if not step one, then what was the step you took to convince you, aha, there's something unusual going
on
here?
Well, Melvin mentioned it. I went out to the area where this took place, where he said that he picked up the old man. And, you know, it's like every other case. You start with a crime scene. Now, this is not really a crime scene, but it's similar to that. And so I went out there and started looking at the area and so on. And I noticed that up into the mountains, the dirt road that he said that he picked up the old man led up into the mountains there. in western Nevada, and so I got in my SUV and I drove up the road, and I came upon mine after mine after mine. Of course, they're all abandoned now, but it was obvious that these mines at one time had been working mines. And I thought, well, let's go to Esmeralda County and Goldfield, which is the county seat, and take a look at the records and see if there's anything there showing that Howard Hughes was involved in any of the mines in this area. And it's a big mining area, that whole section of the country. And as I started going through these old records, I found that the Hughes Tool Company had purchased a lot of mines in the area, particularly, I think there were 34 of them. And I determined through some of the plot maps and so on that those particular mines, those 34 mines, were located at the end of that road where Melvin Dumar found the old man.
Quite a coincidence.
Quite a coincidence. And that's what kind of lit the spark in my mind that maybe there's something to this. And so I continued my investigation and determined that Howard Hughes did have an option to buy those mines at the exact time that Melvin picked him up. So I thought, well, maybe there's something to this.
Okay. Of course, you're a couple of miles down the road from the Cottontail Ranch. Did you start investigating that and what possible connection there could be to that?
Yeah, this area, if your callers are knowledgeable about it, is a barren area where there really is nothing. The closest town is Goldfield. I think it's 32 miles north of there. The only other structure in that whole area is the Cottontail Ranch, and that's located at Lyda Junction or Lyda Junction and Highway 95. And so I went there, and I knocked on the door, and a woman came to the door and asked me what I wanted, and I asked her if Beverly Harrell was there. I was my investigation had determined that Beverly Harrell was the proprietor of the place. And she told me that Beverly was no longer there. She had passed away some years before. And now the brothel was closed and they were renovating it. And I asked her if she had ever heard of Howard Hughes being there, and she didn't even know who Howard Hughes was. And that's the extent of that investigation at that point. And then what I did, I turned my sights on the court record. So I went down to Clark County in Las Vegas, Clark County Courts, and I began going through the court records of this probate trial that took place in 1977 and 1978.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll look at the clues that you got from the court records, and we'll talk about the search for a mysterious woman known as Sunny. Stick around on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast. We're talking with Melvin Dumar and Gary Magnuson. Gary, you went down to Las Vegas to look into the records of the trial, the probate court, and were you convinced that this had become sort of a miscarriage of justice or a railroad job?
Yes, as I began going through a lot of the transcripts and going through many of the records, it was very clear to me that a conspiracy had been hatched here regarding this thing. There were two parties to the lawsuit. Of course, those that were in favor of the will, who said that it was a legitimate will, and then there was the other side who said that it was a phony will, and they opposed the will. And those that opposed the will, they spent $3 million in witness fees, in expert testimony, and so on, and so, investigators and so on, in 1978. And that would be a lot of money today. That would be in excess of $20 million today. And what happened, what I was able to find, was that there was witness intimidation. There were at least two witnesses that were intimidated. One changed his testimony, and one testified truthfully, an expert, but she was intimidated by the president of the American Handwriting Association not to testify because he was testifying on behalf of the opponents of the will. I found evidence of obstruction of justice, witness tampering, possible jury tampering, and perjury. The perjury was committed by the aides that were close to Howard Hughes. There were a number of them, and they were the only people that actually saw Howard Hughes face to face. Howard Hughes conducted all of his business during the period that he was in Las Vegas living at the Desert Inn. He conducted his business either by handwritten memoranda on yellow lined paper or over the telephone. And these aides were the only ones that had day-to-day, face-to-face contact with him. And they testified in the trial, each one of them, that Howard Hughes at no time ever left the confines of the ninth floor of the Desert Inn. And I tracked down one of the jurors in the case, and he told me that the jury basically disregarded the handwriting experts. There were five handwriting experts for the opponents and five handwriting experts for the proponents of the will, and they all contradicted each other. Five said that the will was a forgery, and five said the will was handwritten by Howard Hughes. And so what they did is they discounted that testimony because it was so contradictory. And what they based their decision basically on was that Howard Hughes had never left the Desert Inn. And this came from the testimony of those aides. And so they determined, well, if he never left the Desert Inn, then he could never have been out in the desert, and Melvin Dumar could never have picked him up.
Let's talk about the will and the handwriting for a second.
Okay.
Now, did you do any of your own investigation? Did you ever have your own analysis done independent of what went on at the trial about how legitimate it was?
Yes. Unfortunately, the original will that was used in the trial and that was said to be Howard Hughes' will has been destroyed. The Clark County Clerk's Office has destroyed it. They have a vault with evidence from all the various cases they have down there, and this was in the vault along with a lot of other evidence from the trial for many, many years. And there had been no movement or any inquiries regarding the case for years and years, so they then destroyed it, and it's gone forever.
Wow, so you'd think that'd be something you'd hang on to, a handwritten will
sure
by Howard Hughes?
And I was hoping that there would be the envelope that the will was found in, and I was hoping that we could do DNA evidence on the envelope where he would have licked the envelope to close it. But, of course, that's gone, too, so there was nothing I could do. The only thing we have at this point is copies of the will, and those are not good enough to make any kind of handwriting analysis.
In general, though, I mean, the nature of how it was scribbled out, the mistakes in grammar and things of that sort, is that consistent with what you've learned about Howard Hughes?
Very consistent, yes, very consistent. The aides, even though they perjured themselves regarding him leaving the Desert Inn, they all testified to several elements. They all said that it was a holographic will. That means it was handwritten by the maker of the will and the signer of the will. They all said that Howard Hughes told them that the will was written on yellow lined paper. They were all told by Howard Hughes that they were not specifically named in the will, but they were mentioned by their position, meaning they were named as aides and key employees. He also told them that the will was held by a trusted employee, a trusted courier that no one knew about, and so he told all of them this, and this will fits exactly into that pattern. In addition to that, there was expert testimony during the trial by an ATF agent who analyzed the ink on the used to write the will, and he determined that during the time that Howard Hughes lived in Las Vegas, he used a certain particular pen. It was a Papermate pen that had that particular ink, and Papermate stopped making that ink, I believe, in 1970. So it all fit together, and it appeared to me that this was a legitimate will, and that there was a great miscarriage of justice during the trial.
But of course, without the will, you needed to prove that Howard Hughes at least one time left the Desert Inn, right?
That's correct. That's correct. Because
the
testimony was that he never left.
So how'd you do it?
Well, I talked to as many people as I could that were familiar with him back then. We have to remember this was 30 years later, so it was very difficult to find people. The first person I spoke with was a man by the name of John Meyer. John Meyer was employed by Howard Hughes, and he was the man that acquired hundreds of mines in Western Nevada on behalf of the Hughes Tool Company. And I was able to get a hold of him, and after some contacts with him, he finally told me that Howard Hughes had left the Desert Inn, and then he himself had taken him up to Tonopah, Nevada. And then I put an ad in the newspaper to try to determine if anyone was familiar with Howard Hughes being in the area and so on in the newspapers in western Nevada. And about that same time, Melvin was interviewed by a reporter for one of these small newspapers, and they kind of went over the story again with him. And Melvin told them for the first time that he picked up the old man who identified himself as Howard Hughes about 7 miles south of Lida Junction. And up until this time, he had always just said he had picked up the old man between, I think, Tonopah and Beatty or something, or out in the desert. It was never that specific. And there was a man in Las Vegas by the name of Robert Darrell. And Associated Press picked up this story from the small newspaper in Nevada and ran it in the Review Journal in Las Vegas. And Robert Darrell read it, and it was as if he had been struck by lightning, because he read in there Lida Junction. And he made contact with Melvin the same way that the reporters did when everything broke. He called his relatives in Gabs, Nevada, and they gave him Melvin's telephone number. He called Melvin, talked to him a little bit, and then Melvin put him in touch with me. And Robert Darrell tells the story that he was a pilot, that he was in charge of the North Las Vegas Airport back at the time that Howard Hughes lived in Las Vegas. Howard Hughes had purchased the North Las Vegas Airport, and he had flown Howard Hughes to the Cottontail Ranch on two occasions, the last occasion being between Christmas and New Year's of 1967.
Meaning exactly the time that Melvin says that he picked him up.
Exactly the time and exactly the place. And so it was quite exciting to hear that. Mr. Darrell is a very reliable witness. He is a self-made millionaire. He's been very successful. He is very well known in Las Vegas. He is a very credible witness and has given me enough details and enough information that I've been able to corroborate that I believe that he is absolutely telling the truth.
Well, I can verify for the audience that Bob Darrow is very well known, very well respected, has a good reputation here. He's made a lot of money, has a lot of friends, and high society, and yeah, he's a pretty credible guy. Melvin, I want to ask you a quick question before we go to our break. As Gary is finding out this new information, is he telling you about it, and are you kind of getting into the whole thing all over again? Melvin, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. He did tell me, you know, some of the things he was finding. I don't think he told me everything, but I got quite excited to find out some of the things that he was learning, and so I ran down a lot of people myself that had information, and if I felt in my own mind that they were credible, then I turned them over to Gary because I wanted him to check them out too. So
I just wondered if you were not letting yourself get excited about this thing because you'd been burned so many times before.
Well, I think the thing that really got me excited was when Gary told me about the, you know, right where I picked him up and the time I picked him up, you know, about it being recorded in the, you know, on some of that stuff. You know, it's hard to dispute. And after I went there myself and checked it out, I mean, that's when I started getting excited.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with more of Gary Magnuson and Melvin Dumar's amazing story about the encounter with Howard Hughes and all the legal battles that have ensued since then. Stick with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Melvin Dumar and Gary Magnuson. I'll bet Melvin Dumar knows the words to that song, and maybe before the night's over, we'll get him to sing us something. If you're recapping this story, we know that the Melvin Dumar's tale about meeting Howard Hughes in the desert was regarded as false because all the aides to Howard Hughes said Howard Hughes never left the confines of the Desert Inn during the 4 years that he lived in Las Vegas. However, a new witness surfaced during Gary Magnuson's investigation, a businessman and pilot named Bob Darrow from Las Vegas, who says that at least twice he flew Howard Hughes to central Nevada to the Cottontail Ranch, a brothel, to meet a mysterious woman named Sunny. When we come back, we'll hear more about Sunny's tale and about how Bob Darrow explains the story on how Howard Hughes got separated from him. So stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're talking with Gary Magnuson and Melvin Dumar about an encounter with Howard Hughes. At the top of this hour, we'll be joined by attorneys Stuart Stein and Ron Greening, who will tell us where the case is heading and what they hope to accomplish. But for the time being, we're going to finish our story about Bob Darrow. Gary, would you explain how it is that Bob Darrow possibly got separated from Howard Hughes? He's flying him out to the Cottontail Ranch. Why wouldn't you want to keep an eye on the guy who's worth a couple of billion dollars even back then?
Well, you certainly would, but you have to remember who the boss was, and that was Howard Hughes. So anyway, they flew him. He flew him up there in a little Cessna. He landed. There's an airstrip there at the Cottontail. He landed on that airstrip. And I asked Darrow, well, what was Howard Hughes wearing that night? And he gave the exact description of the clothing that he was wearing that Melvin gave of the man that he picked up in the desert. The man that he picked up in the desert had no jacket on. This was in the middle of the winter. It was 42 degrees that night. And so it would have been chilly, very cold, but he didn't wear a jacket. And the reason he didn't is because the plane taxied right up near the Cottontail. Darrow and Howard Hughes both got out and just made a short walk into the Cottontail. Now, Howard had been with a lot of women throughout his life, a lot of movie starlets and so on and so forth, so he liked women. But he had been with this woman whom Darrow identified as Sunny on at least four occasions, twice at another brothel and then two times at the Cottontail. And so he went there to see Sonny. And he and Sonny went off together to the room, and Darrow went to the bar. And he was a fairly young man at the time, and he had a couple of too many drinks and realized that he couldn't fly that plane in the condition he was in. And so he asked Beverly Harrell, who owned the place and ran the place, if he could find somewhere where he could lie down and take a nap for a while. So she allowed him to go into the kitchen where he lay down and took a nap. Unfortunately, he didn't awaken until about 5 o'clock the next morning when the maid woke him up. And he said, well, where's my friend? And she says, what friend? And he said, well, the guy I came here with. And she said, oh, he left. And Darrow says, what do you mean he left? Where did he go? She said, I have no idea. He just left. And so Darrow panicked. He's lost Howard Hughes. But he didn't know what to do, and no one seemed to know where he had gone. But he knew that he had left the brothel. And so he got in his airplane and took off and circled the area for some time, trying to see if he could find the old man anywhere. He couldn't find him. And so all he could do then was return to the North Las Vegas airport. It's about an hour flight. And he landed and just waited for the call that he was fired. But that call never came. And the call from Howard Hughes never came. And he never spoke to him again. He was not fired. As a matter of fact, he was promoted. He was given a very good job became a vice president of a bank in Los Angeles, which he assumes was as a result of Howard Hughes, but he was never told that. So now we have Howard Hughes at the Cottontail Ranch on the exact date, the exact time that Melvin Dumar picked him up 7 miles south of the Cottontail Ranch.
Tell me about the search for Sunny, this woman.
We have tried and tried and tried to find her. All that we know about her is that the time that all of this happened, she was supposedly a very beautiful woman, but she had a very unusual characteristic. She had a diamond embedded in one of her front teeth, which was very, very unusual. And I have spoken to several people who knew her. several people who remember her working there. I have even spoken to a person who knows exactly what took place between Sonny and Howard Hughes, and it's not exactly what people may think. We're holding that information back because of the fact that if someone comes forward and says they're Sonny, we'll know if they're telling the truth or not based on what they tell us what took place in the room.
Wasn't
so
there a
we're
painting
looking
of
for
her?
Sonny.
Okay, wasn't there a painting of Sonny at the Cottontail?
Yes, there was a painting of Sonny hanging in the Cottontail. It was hand-painted. I even tried to find the artist that did that, and I was not able to find that person. But I did find Howard Harrell, the husband of Beverly Harrell, the madam. And he told me that Beverly had told him that Howard Hughes had been to the Cottontail Ranch, and that during the trial she wanted to come forward and testify to that fact. But her husband talked her out of it, saying that if you do this, you're going to cause a lot of problems for yourself, and the authorities will probably pull your license, and you'll lose your business and everything else. And so she was convinced that she should not go forward and testify.
Now, one of the reasons you're doing this show is because you hope that Sonny, who would have to be an elderly lady by this time,
yes,
or someone who would know her, that this idea of a diamond in her tooth might trigger a memory, right?
That's exactly right. And we hope that someone may know who she is. We'd love to have her true name. We'd love to know if she's still alive, where we can find her if she is, and that would be extremely helpful.
So you're saying that Howard Hughes didn't go there to the Cottontail for sort of the same sort of wham-bam kind of activity that other customers might go there for?
That's correct.
And, I mean, do you have hope that you are actually going to find Sonny at some point?
Well, I sure hope so, but I have no way of knowing if she's still alive or where she is. She may have originally been from Minnesota, from the Minneapolis area, but we're not sure of that. And other than that, we don't know anything about her. We don't know her true name. She always went by Sonny, and she was very, very popular.
So Bob Darrow says that Howard Hughes was outside the DI. Johnny Meyer says Howard Hughes was outside the DI. What other witnesses did you come up with? For example, I was always curious about who is the person, the mystery person, who dropped off the Mormon will to the gas station where Melvin worked. Any ideas?
Yes, his name was Levain Forsythe, and he did come forward during the trial, but he was threatened. He got a threatening phone call, was told not to testify if he knew what was good for him, and he panicked. His deposition was read into the court record, but it didn't have the same effect that a live witness would have had. So, yeah, I know who he was. He says that he was that courier that Howard Hughes had told his aides about that had the will, and he delivered it. Now, why he delivered it to Melvin, I don't know.
Is he still alive?
I think he just had a hot potato on his hands and figured that I might as well give it to Melvin, let him deal with it.
Is he still alive, Levain Forsythe?
No, he passed away, I believe, in 1988.
Melvin, did you see any photos of Levain Forsythe, and is he the guy? If so, is he the guy that came to the gas station?
Well, yes, I was taken up to Anchorage, Alaska, where he was residing, actually before the trial. And what they did when we first got to Anchorage, they put a magazine, like a company magazine, in front of me and asked me if I recognized any of the pictures of the people in the magazine. There was about 200 different pictures in there. And there was one person that looked familiar to me, and then there was Levain Forsythe. And I told the attorneys that I believed he was the man that brought the will to me. And then later on that evening, Levain showed up. We were at the Captain Cook Hotel in Anchorage, and they put me and one of the attorneys off in a darkened corner and told Levain to go pick me out of the crowd. It was rather crowded in there, and he walked straight up to me and said, "Hello, Melvin."
Well, let's talk about the so-called Mormon Mafia, the guys who are around Howard Hughes. I mean, they are, if we are to believe that intimidation is taking place, that witnesses are being threatened, these are the guys that you suspect are behind it, right, Gary?
Yes, either they or someone higher up in the Hughes organization, and so they, of course, did not want the facts to come out at all. They wanted the jury to believe that Howard Hughes never left, and so anyone that would contradict that, they put the pressure on.
You know, you'll read about Howard Hughes and how the last few years of his life went, and it's, you know, it's easy to dismiss him as some sort of a crazy old drug addict or something, but it's also a tragic story, being so isolated, being so dependent on his aides. In many respects, he was completely at their mercy.
He was, and they controlled him. He had several plane crashes. He was a very famous pilot, and as a result of these crashes, he was injured severely and was in pain constantly. And he became addicted to codeine. He had three doctors on his staff that only attended to him, and they provided him with codeine, and he became an addict. Excuse me. And the aides used this to control him.
Who would have orchestrated this thing? I know there's a guy named Bill Gay who died late last year, who was sort of at the top of the heap in the Hughes organization, other than Robert Mayhew, was the guy on the outside. I mean, is that your suspicion, or are you going to get in trouble even saying anything about that?
Well, I'll have to ask Stuart about that, but that is my suspicion, yes.
And they would have been doing what? Orchestrating the trial, influencing the trial so that none of this money went to not only just to Melvin, but I guess to a lot of other places as well.
Well, yes, Bill Gay controlled the empire. He was the man in charge. And once Hughes was out of the way, he had the whole thing. And so he didn't want to lose that. And so I think he wanted to hang on to the whole kit and caboodle, so to speak. And so he had an awful lot to lose if that will was found legitimate. I also want to add that during this whole time, the Attorney General of Nevada pursued Melvin with all the power of the state of Nevada, and came after him and after him and after him, trying to prove that Melvin forged the will. He was never able to prove that. And so when the trial ended and the jury basically said that they believed that it was not Howard Hughes' will, because, as I said earlier, he had never left, and so Melvin could never have picked him up, then everyone thought Melvin was a crook, and that's the way it was left in 1978. And Melvin's had to live with this curse basically since that time. And in Utah, especially, everybody knows the name Melvin Dumar. And when he's introduced, or when he went to get a job, the light bulb would go off in people's heads, and they say, "Oh, here's this nut, or here's this crook." And so he's had to carry that burden for all these years.
What about the possibility that Melvin was a dupe, was used by someone else, maybe the Mormon Church, that someone else was responsible for writing that will and dropping it off to him, and so that they wouldn't have their fingerprints on it? If Melvin was not capable or uninterested in producing a false document like that, did you, in fact, investigate who else might possibly be responsible?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at it logically. The people named in the will would be the only ones that would benefit if the will was found to be legitimate. And therefore, you have to look at the Boy Scouts of America. Would they have concocted such a will? No, they didn't even know they were in the will. You look at the church. They didn't. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They didn't know they were in the will. The various universities named in there, they didn't know they were in the will. An orphanage for boys, and so on and so forth. So the only people that would have benefited from this will was Melvin Dumar or Noah Dietrich, who was named as the executor of the will. Noah Dietrich was a former employee of Howard Hughes who ran his empire until he was fired in 1957, I believe. And so the only logical assumption is that either Melvin or Noah Dietrich were somehow involved in forging the will. If Melvin was involved in forging the will, how did he know about the Papermate pen and the exact ink that Howard Hughes used to write? How did he know about the yellow notebook paper that Howard Hughes wrote? How would he know the two marriages that Howard Hughes had when his first marriage was basically secret? How would he know that what Howard Hughes looked like back then? The only people that knew what Howard Hughes looked like were the aides, and he described him to a T exactly how he actually did look back then. How did Melvin know that? So I discount Melvin as the forger. It would have to be, if the document was forged, then it would have to be someone that had intimate knowledge of Howard Hughes and exactly what he was doing during the period of time that he was in Las Vegas. And the only people that knew that were the aides, and they fought against the will.
The aide who probably spent more time with Howard Hughes than anyone is a guy named Gordon Margulis, and I've met him a couple times. He seems to be a really straight shooter. He cared for Mr. Hughes, both literally and figuratively, wept when the guy died, and he swears, both publicly and privately, that Hughes was just too weak to have been able to get out of the Desert Inn during the time that he lived there. What do you say to Gordon Margulis, who I think you would agree is not one of these guys who's part of this suspected cabal?
No, and not all of the aides were either. There was one that was especially a good guy, and I've spoken to him, but there were several of them were definitely they were crooks. Gordon Margulis truly believes that he could not have left, and I think that he is being honest. But Howard Hughes had his ups and downs. Some days he would be lucid. Some days he would almost be comatose. But there were days when he was able to function very well. And not only did he take codeine and other drugs, but he also took amphetamines from time to time. And so that would boost him. There was an aide by the name of Howard Eckersley that I believe is the one that transported him to the airport so he could fly with Robert Darrow. And so he wouldn't have had to walk very far. I think Eckersley probably helped carry him down the stairs to a waiting car, and they drove up to North Las Vegas Airport. From there, he only would have had to walk a few paces to the airplane, and then they flew up there, and then a few paces from the airplane to the brothel. So he didn't really have to be a marathon runner, you know. I mean, he could function.
You also believe that you have an idea about why Howard Hughes would have been dropped off by Melvin, by the Sands, instead of by the DI.
Yes. Remember that he asked Melvin for some money, and Melvin gave him some change. Howard Hughes was never seen, as I said, by anyone outside of the Desert Inn during the time he lived there. He didn't want to be seen in public, and so he would never have walked into the casino, and he looked like a bum, for one thing. The guards probably would have thrown him out. And so what I assume he did is he took that change and went to a payphone and made a phone call to one of his aides and told them to come pick him up. The Sands was right next door to the Desert Inn. I remember when I first was transferred to Las Vegas, that both of those hotels existed. They were next to each other, and it wouldn't have been any kind of a problem at all for the aide to pick him up right next door and then take him back up the stairs up to the ninth floor.
Okay, Gary Magnuson, hold on. Melvin Dumar, hold on. We'll be joined in a couple of minutes by attorneys Stuart Stein and Ron Greening to see where this case goes from here. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.